Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Leanne Ellison Norman. Leanne Ellison Norman was born in the Rocky Mountains of Montana, the eldest of four daughters of a Forest Service range ecologist and an elementary school teacher. She grew up in the Wasatch Mountains of Utah, was educated in Iowa and Massachusetts, and has lived in Pittsburgh for the last 45 years. Norman won the Wisteria Prize for Poetry in 2006 from Paper Journey Press. She has published two earlier books of poetry, The Duration of Grief and Keep, a book about nonviolent protest against nuclear bomb parts makers entitled Mere Citizens United, Civil and Disobedient, a biography entitled Hammer of Justice, Molly Rush and the Plowshares 8, and Stitches in Air, a novel about Mozart's mother. Her new book of poems is entitled Breathing the West, Great Basin Poems, published by Bottom Dog Press in 2012. And we're really happy to have Leanne here today to read from this new book. So, hi, Leanne.
Hi, Jan. It's good to see you.
Always good to see you. And congratulations once again on this book. It's such a beautiful book.
And, thank you.
And was a really a long time coming for this.
It was. Yeah. I don't know why that is particularly. I think it's a pretty good book.
That's right, it is. So you're going to start with some poems.
I'm going to. This book is sort of biographical in that it talks about the growing up in the West. And this is a poem about my parents' courtship called Waiting. Young and poor, Lincoln wrote in his journal that by 1933, when he'd be 25, he expected he'd have gone on at least two scientific expeditions to foreign countries, be recognized as a leader of my field. Not until then, he wrote, is it time to talk of getting married. But in 1933, the Great Depression altered everything. Refugees from prairie states, land denuded of soil by wind, destructive farming practices, headed south and west. Jobs were scarce. In Europe, the Reichstag fire, first concentration camp, nothing was as he expected. Nevertheless, Lincoln asked Laurel to marry him. Next day, an offer of work in Idaho, Priest River Station, report immediately. They married in a hurry, under a rose-trimmed arch on a dewy evening, the bride in a skin of ruffled satin. The two virgins had just one night together. He caught the train next morning for Spokane, Missoula, Priest River, wrote her he knew genuine content for the first time in his life. Then news that he might have to supervise a crew of CCC or ECW men in the wilds. April ended, May, then June. Sometimes Forest Service money ran out, plans changed again, but he always had work. Back in her little town, Laurel wrote, everyone looked askance, wondered why the bridegroom had done a bunk. They waited through July, through August. The Forest Service, he wrote, is not going to keep us apart. He had saved up money. Why not put in the winter in the North Woods? $200 will grubstake a pretty long winter. There would be time for reading and writing, many a ski and snowshoe journey, many a long evening of talk and lovemaking and music. Hi-ya! Laurel was packed, ready to join him. Then, once again, the Forest Service was out of money. He'd work for the Park Service in Glacier Park, mapping timber types, women not allowed. He wrote, come, dear, let us find Vega every night, each of us. It will be our own particular kind of prayer. Snow fell in September. In November, finally, the letters stop. They're what I have to go on. They'd been married 7 months before they, who would in 5 years be my parents, first lived together. Here's one about this same romance. This was when my parents were dating, and my father was working for the Forest Service in Bogalusa, Louisiana, and my mother stayed behind in Southern California. So this is taken from my father's letters to my mother, Bogalusa Romance, 1932. I am beginning, Lincoln wrote his beloved, to take an aboriginal delight in nudity. Walking back to his rooms from plots where he made measurements of broadleaf pine, he stopped to swim as often as he could. Ah, the luxury of the cool water! What strange bell-like chimings it makes to the submerged ear, and how I love to see it pour, swift swirling, around my higher shoulder. Lincoln wrote to Laurel, "If a bumblebee is drunk, is he to blame or the flower? Would the rising cost of postage, the 3-cent stamp, make writing to her a luxury? Sweetheart, you've been a luxury since ever I've known you." Finding Vega in the night sky linked them, the brightest star of Lyra, burning itself up faster than the rival sun. Laurel sent her kiss by way of Vega, occasioning a lesson in astronomy. "If your kiss should travel with the speed of light, it would drop down to me in my 84th year." I'm going to read one called Practical Men. And there's a little quote at the beginning from my father's journals at 17, "Stayed home and dug post holes today." Practical Men. Scholar and dreamer, Lincoln liked practical men, the Norwegian sheepherder in outback Montana who showed him how to castrate sheep with his teeth. He weeded the victory garden, fixed the office typewriter so all but the carriage return worked, built shower houses and decks and walls for tents, bought giant cooking pots for the 1939 seminar on range management. He built 3 rooms on the 2nd floor of our house, grew a buccaneer's mustache, chortled as he twirled the ends. On Sundays, he made pancakes, flipping them up, catching with the frying pan. Trying to figure out original growth in the subalpine zone of the Wasatch Plateau, he read back issues of the Ephraim Enterprise, talked to old-timers. A 74-year-old sheep herder remembered the range covered in broadleaf plants, not grasses, though another spoke up for grasses so tall they nearly hid the sheep and cattle run by herders for their owners over the range they thought was free. Lincoln said, "Human beings are never so clearly an element in the balance of nature as when they destroy the balance." And I think it's time to get one in here about my mother. Mother sewing. She made clothes for our Christmas Madame Alexander dolls, mine blonde like me, my dark-haired sister's dark. Wool coats from scraps of her winter coat, lined with matching rayon for shoes, the fingertips of her worn gloves. All made in secret, though we heard the hum of her sewing machine, refused to put 2 and 2 together. We had little sisters to fool and wanted to believe in Santa Claus. Before I went to college, had to take a formal, we found a gleaming yardage of green and pale gray shimmering stuff, the bodice lined with silvery silk, green velvet straps, conferring royal carriage. Maybe it was Butterick, maybe Vogue, patterns she'd taught me to lay on the straight of cloth, some pieces on the bias, stitching on the singer she'd bought and my father groused about, a luxury. She made us pinafores, sunbonnets, curtains, upholstery for the couch and chairs my father refinished. I pushed her away in adolescence. She tried to land on moons that circled my private planet. I wanted physics. She insisted on pep club so I'd be popular. She wanted a pretty, pliant daughter. I was plain and academic. I fought her, and she fought back, each wounded the other. But she stood by me, called it crucifixion, when the men I worked with savaged my accomplishment in secret, so I had no way of answering. She taught me always to baste the zippers in, the darts, collars, sleeves, taught me to save the scraps.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Leanne Ellison Norman. She's reading from her book of poems, Breathing the West, Great Basin Poems. Leanne, I wanted to ask you about the process of writing this book. from, did you actually use your father's journals when you did this?
My father died quite young, and my mother at some point sent me boxes of his journals and letters and publications. For a while, I thought I would write his biography, and I was working on that, and my youngest daughter died, and I put it aside. And when I came back to it, I decided there wasn't really a biography there because he'd worked for the Forest Service all his life, and although he had, I think, an interesting life, it was kind of a straight line. But his prose particularly was so good. He wanted to be a poet, but he wasn't a very good poet, but he was really a superb prose writer. So I decided to write a book of poetry about the experience of growing up in our household, and particularly in these kind of remote places in the Wasatch Mountains. The next poem that I want to read is about a snow surveyor's cabin where the six of us lived in the summers. It was above timber. It had cold running water. It had an outhouse about a block away. Our refrigerator was a mountain stream outside. It was called the Alpine Cabin, and we had a splendid time living there. And a picture of the Alpine Cabin is on the cover of this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you read that, and then I'll ask you another question.
Okay. Alpine Cabin. Each late June, the road then almost clear of snowdrifts, we arrived, mother's head aching from altitude. But she'd spread out the tablecloth, hang the blue plaid ruffles she'd made across each window, send us out for wildflowers, homemaking bouquet, while Daddy started the fire with aspen kindling, adding coal from the dented scuttle. Some mornings at first light, I'd wake to see an elk lofting his rack of antlers, nosing the air for danger. I'd watch as long as my bladder held, then dash the city block across the buttercup-bordered stream to the outhouse. Sometimes the elk stood still, watching this wild thing, bareheaded, scramble on two legs. Sometimes he'd startle, bound away. The cabin was square, log and block, built for snow surveyors, icy water in the sink. The stream outside cooled milk, fresh melons brought up from Ephraim once a week with books from the library. I went back 20 years ago, remembrance bubbling like the spring that fed the stream. My mother's flowered tablecloth faded, blue ruffles gray, drooping along the tops of windows. Hanging on the wall, the galvanized tub where we girls bathed in water, heated on the coal stove, taking turns. Always coffee in the black enamel pot, perfume of bread rising or fresh baked. Just off the kitchen, a pantry, space for cans of Spam, Borden's canned milk, quart jars of last summer's tomatoes, peaches, apricots, battered table where Daddy worked on his subalpine vegetation of the Wasatch Plateau. Six cots in the only other room, each flanked by an orange crate, holding crayons for the good sides of used paper, scissors, tape. On clear nights, we had a bonfire, sparks jostling stars. Daddy played his guitar, and Mother taught us songs. Nights inside, by kerosene lamplight, I made into paper dolls all the characters in books, Glinda the Good Witch, Alice, Red Queen, Rapunzel. As the kitchen fire burned down, we were quick into cold cocoons of canvas, kapok, army surplus, khaki wool.
You have so many evocative details in your poems, and especially in that one that you just read. And as you said on the cover of the book, you have the photograph of the cabin.
Yes.
And, you know, the book is so grounded in history and family. I'm wondering if you could talk about what it feels like to have that sense of, like, if there's a sense of legacy from writing this book and getting these things down in sort of your version of it, and
yes,
what that feels like.
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, not only was the experience unusual for not too many American families at that time, this was in the 50s, lived in these circumstances, So that seems important to me, the handmadeness of it all, the sort of roughing it aspect of it all. And it's a time that can't be recovered. So in addition to wanting to pay homage to my father and my mother and my sisters, I wanted to capture something about that time and living in that extremely simple and I think marvelous way. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And since you chose poetry rather than autobiography or biography, you know, we know that with poetry things don't have to be true. All the details don't have to be necessarily true. So I'm wondering if you took some liberties with description and memory.
Well, of course, memory can always be imperfect. I tried not to. I really wanted to tell the truth in this book because I wanted, among other things, to be a record for my children and grandchildren and the people that they're associated with, and really a record of this particular kind of past, which is, I think, unusual.
Okay. Could you read some more?
Yeah. This one's written more from a contemporary perspective. It's Round Trip. Lewis and Clark, sure they could reach the Pacific, came upon ragged range after range, losing heart, hungry, cold. They couldn't turn back. But I fly west over fields etched in winter's fallow to snowy fabric rucked up into mountains, folded rocks laid down by ancient seas, volcanic thrust and buckle. The engine vibrates through the cold floor. From here the snow looks dusted, though it lies deep in those crevasses, on those peaks, nestled forests, a range called Never Know Summers. No telling if I'm seeing rivers or valleys, what creatures hibernate, what germinates in dark places, what soil enriches in decay. Now cascades, three volcanoes, Adams, Hood, Rainier, jagged surround, close enough to touch, as the plane heads down through fog to land. Earthbound, I take a bus downtown, eat mussels in sunshine on Elliott Bay, edged by the snowy peaks I've just flown over. 3 days later, I reverse, Cascades, desert, Great Salt Lake, Wasatch Front, the badlands of Utah and Colorado, flat and arid. Coming into Denver, foothills left behind, a rim of rose on the horizon, lights wispy clouds. We burn jet fuel and time coming in to land. On east, the sky blackens, lateness accelerates, one metropolis of lights, another burning up the world I have just flown over. This poem is called Inheritance. I'd like to drink a cup of coffee with my father at the kitchen table, red oak like satin under elbows, cream-colored mugs with wide blue bands, daffodils in the blue speckled jug watching the backyard unwind to green, trilliums blooming briefly while ferns push up their coiled fiddleheads and violets raise small faces. We'd watch birds at the feeder and the squirrels that soar like arias in the ancient, damaged maple. He wrote in his Montana Journal, 1936, "To my astonishment, I found in the limestone a mass of seashells. Seashells, 4,000 feet above Vigilante, itself 6,000 feet above the sea. What visionary mollusk ever dreamed that he would be lifted so high?" We'd laugh about the coffee sheep herders used to serve us from their wagons, along with mutton, sourdough biscuits, tales of bears, coyotes, derring do, coffee boiled, reboiled, more grounds added, till a spoon could stand alone. I want to tell him all that's happened since that half a century ago on John Paul Jones Ridge, where he and three friends, equipped with packs, first aid supplies, and tools, rode the ski lift to the top, hiked, strips of moleskin strapped underside their skis, the nap for traction, ate lunch, conversed among the trees. He led off, a downhill run, when the avalanche, silent to one companion, a roar to the other, swept him down, buried him in 15 feet of snow. But if by magic we could share that cup of coffee, who would we be? He was 6 months shy of 50 when he died. I'm 73. He was slender, neat, his black brush cut, thick eyebrows, clear blue eyes looking out across mountains, grieving irretrievable loss of soil, fingers showing me stamen and anther of a flower. He read to us in the kitchen as we four did dinner dishes to keep us from fighting. Stevenson's Black Arrow, the mysterious eye spying from tapestry, up to no good, Lamb's essay on roast pig, his delight in words. He wrote to his young wife, my mother, our language is a rich, beautiful one. I love it and do not like to see it mistreated.
Nice poem.
Yeah, I like that.
One thing I like about your poems is that they make me feel like I'm in the West, or they make me feel the West, you know, like it's right here, which is so great. And also make me want to write poems. I mean, it's just like traveling, reading and hearing your poems. So,
well, there is a different air in the West. It's mostly drier. At high altitudes, it's very clear and a little thin. And things may have changed. I haven't been back to the West for a long time, but it's a kind of special place. Growing up, my family were the 6 non-Mormons in this little Mormon town of Ephraim, Utah. We were the entire Gentile population. And people were always trying to convert my parents. And one time, a pair of young, fresh-faced missionaries came to our house and were into their spiel, and one of them looked earnestly at my father, and he said, "Now, wouldn't you like to think, sir, that after your death, you'd be married to this fine woman for time and eternity?" And he sort of looked at my mother and cocked his head and said, "Oh, I don't know. One lifetime might be enough."
Well, that's interesting because, you know, I was still thinking about his romantic letters and his,
yes,
and they were so great, and the nudity and the stars, and that seems like something you'd want to continue. really interesting.
That, I think one of the things was the missionaries never knew what to answer to anything unscripted. This next poem is Rock Island Line to Omaha, Union Pacific to Ogden, March 8th, 1958. Mother's voice on the shared dormitory phone, thinned by half a continent. Daddy's gone. Come home. I bought train tickets for my sister and me at the little station in Grinnell. As I rescheduled midterms, one professor pressed a flask on me filled with forbidden single malt whiskey against shock. We tried it on the train in cone-shaped paper cups, hardened our lips against its smoky slap. For 36 hours, we clanked and whistled across prairie, antelope racing alongside, the train winding down through Wyoming's startled rocks. Neighbors came all day into night, bringing food, newspaper accounts of the avalanche, the young rescuer also lost in snow, his pregnant wife. Grandma E had keened, was now dry-eyed and withered. We all shook hands, greeted old friends, wreathed in condolences, found space in the refrigerator for another Jell-O salad, another pie on the chilly back porch. We held up through the obsequies, all of us on display. One woman told another, who told us, we must not have cared much, we shed no tears. After the funeral, Mother collapsed, and I kneaded her back till she slept, a rag doll whose stuffing had run out. When crocuses, then daffodils, came up through cold black soil at the end of March, I called it resurrection. I poured the whiskey in a mason jar deep in my dorm closet, drank a glass at graduation, poured the rest down the drain. I guess because of my father's influence, I've always really had an interest in the earth, the land, dirt, and the things that come out of it. So this is a more up-to-date poem about archaeology, I guess. It starts with a little quotation from the New York Times in 2008. "The closest living relatives of the mighty predator Tyrannosaurus rex are modern birds." And the poem is "Sioux Bones on Sioux Land," and the two Sioux are spelled S-U-E and S-I-O-U-X. "Sioux Bones on Sioux Land." I look up from the newspaper into the old maple whose fallen blossoms green the walk below. Who knew the dramas we'd watched from here were acted by aerial dinosaurs? Woodpeckers routed from nest and young by murdering starlings, the blue jay that ripped apart the unfledged cardinal baby. It was soft tissue in T-Rex bones matched up with birds, same protein passed link to link down 68 million years. A complete T-Rex named Sue stands in the Field Museum. She's named for the woman who stayed behind on Sioux land while her fellow archaeologist took the flat tire into Faith, South Dakota. Poking around a cliff, she found her namesake, now reassembled, 13 feet high, 42 feet long, 5 foot skull. My son, at 4, asked, which came first, cowboys or dinosaurs? And now my grandson puzzles, birds, descendants of T-Rex? If you eat more, you get smaller? It seems that we're evolved from fish, brains encased in skulls, pairs of eyes, ears, nostrils, arms, backbone, the brain's wiring, sociable habits, hinged mouth and tongue, matched rims of teeth. When the U.S. government in the 19th century defaulted on payments to South Dakota Sioux, one white trader said they were free to eat the grass. The Sioux attacked the trading post, murdered the trader, stuffed his mouth with grass. 38 Sioux hanged. Fighting followed. Dakota, Red Clouds, Great Sioux Wars, massacre at Wounded Knee. T-Rex's teeth evolved to bite, rip, tear. Big fish ate little fish, ventured out of water onto land. Fins became fingers, made pots for soup, cooked meat. Teeth got smaller, thus knives, guns, and nukes.
The poetry of Leanne Ellison Norman, reading from her book, Breathing the West, Great Basin Poems. Thank you so much, Leanne. That was great.
Thank you, Jen. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 FM.